Episode 57 of This Developing Story. So last week I mentioned I was going to do a React training, and I did it. And I completed it. Monday and Tuesday this week I was at Pinterest, did reacttrainingjs.com, I think is the... reactjstraining.com. Did that, did the advanced training course, and it was advanced. Michael Jackson, he's the guy who did React Router with Ryan Florence. They do this training course that I mentioned last week, but yeah, so it was actually really good. I learned a ton. I sort of like the same feeling I did when I did Ember, except I didn't do any training in Ember. I actually did a video course training on the Tility site. I definitely have way more confidence writing React code now. Not that it really required much confidence. You can pretty much get a lot of React code together as long as you know JavaScript. And at this point, I know JavaScript well because I did a lot of JavaScript in the last year. And yeah, so what I'm getting at is, yeah, super awesome course. Highly recommend it if they're coming to your town or if your company will pay for it. That would be really cool. Yeah, so check it out, reactjstraining.com. Met a lot of cool people. Some people actually will have on this podcast, which is actually going to be pretty cool, pretty interesting. I don't know if I do a really good job of meeting people in SF, but I'm trying to change that. So as I go to meetups, hopefully I can get those people on podcasts rather than cold emailing people randomly. So anyway, I'm rambling. This week, actually, I don't have anything to talk about what I shipped this week, but one thing that's really awesome about Netlify is we're open sourcing a lot of the stuff we do, and once we actually finish up the stuff that, like the stuff I'm working on, I'll be able to talk about it more because it'll be open source. You can read the code, I can link the code, I can do blog posts about the code. So that's like one of the reasons why I decided to make the jump to Netlify was, this was one reason. The other reason was some advocacy efforts. Technically part of my role is developer advocate, evangelist. I don't know which term it is. I think I get to make up my own title there, which is also pretty cool. Though I guess I could have did that anywhere. Anyway, what I'm getting at is I just did a podcast. I mentioned I was doing a podcast on focused around the stuff we're doing at Netlify. Recorded that. It's been being edited, which is really cool. I'm not doing the editing. I'm not doing any of the production work. I'm doing it in a studio, which is like pretty awesome. It's part of the accelerator that we're a part of, which is called HeavyBit. It's local to SF. If you have been to a meetup in SF or if you've been here before, go to their meetups because a lot of them are held at this location. And yeah, so we're involved with that. And that podcast is going to be lit. So it's not out yet. I still need to book future guests for that podcast, but once it's unveiled, I'll link it out on Twitter. So follow me on Twitter. And yeah, so getting into this podcast, I have an actual person I've actually known for a couple years now. He showed up when I did the Ruby Newbies originally. A couple years ago, I would meet and do the Odin project, the open source curriculum, and this run through Ruby exercises. And yeah, so he showed up for it, and he showed up again when I revived Ruby Newbies as a Slack community. And yeah, so I've got to know Jeff Thomas. He is a freelance developer. He works remote, and he works in Colorado, which is pretty cool. So I'll let him explain more about what he does and how he got to what he did. Hope you enjoy.
Hi, everyone. My name is Jeff Thomas. I'm a Ruby on Rails developer, mainly doing freelance. Well, pretty much doing all freelance stuff at the moment. As far as how I got into technology, boy, it could go all the way back. I'll spare you all the details, but...
Well, we have time.
It did all start back in the days of the Commodore 64. And ever since then, I've been always interested in computers. Interestingly enough, though, my undergrad was actually biology because I thought I was going to go down that route. But while I was working, or while I was going to school, actually, I worked for the campus networking team. Work study or something like that. Not work study, but...
Like co-op?
Yeah, not co-op, but, you know, I was just... I would work a couple hours here and there to try to help pay for my tuition for school. So it was the campus networking. I just, you know, basically cruised around campus and hooked up computers and did all kinds of stuff. That was back when, like, Apple Talk was popular, and we had a lot of PCs, but most of them were PCs and then a few Apples on the network. So anyway, that's kind of, you know, that's sort of where I really started digging in. And then after college, I was faced with, okay, so what am I going to do? And my options with my biology degree were kind of limited, and I didn't want to continue going to school. So I kind of thought, all right, well, what do I want to do? What have I always done? And these questions, of course, were probably better asked before you start college, but there I was. So I went to school in Minnesota, and then one of the first things I did was move to Colorado, which is always on my list, a place that I always wanted to live. And I got here. I worked for an outdoor store, REI, for a number of years. I started working for them, but I also started thinking, okay, what do I want to do? And so I enrolled in the local community college, just taking some night classes in computers and just some basic programming stuff. And my instructor at the time, he was working at Frontier Airlines. And so I got to know him pretty well. And I think about maybe a semester or two in, he came to me and he's like, hey, Jeff, how would you like a job? So I got my first job as a help desk person for Frontier Airlines way back in the day. And that was a lot of fun. I really did love it. I mean, it was great. I was helping people over the phone, going to their desktops and helping them. But after that, kind of made my way up to network administrator and did that for a while. I had a chance to go live and work in New Zealand for a year, which was pretty cool.
Doing what you were already doing, like?
Yeah. It was kind of interesting because getting a job over there was tricky, right? It's like in order to get a work visa, I had to have a company sponsor me. But when I talked to all the companies, all of them wanted me to have a work visa. So it's sort of this chicken and the egg problem. But we were doing some crazy things. So eCollege is an online learning platform. And we had a number of servers in a cluster for redundancy. And I don't remember all the details, but there was something that was this crazy task that was taking up a lot of our time. And anyways, I dug into a scripting language at the time that ran on Windows. I don't even remember what it was called, like Windows Scripting Host, WSH. I don't even know if it's around anymore, but you could use either JS script or VB script. And I think I went with JS script. I don't know why. But anyway, I basically took this thing, and it had something to do with, I don't know, updating the servers or something. Like I said, I just don't remember the details. But anyway, I automated this whole thing with WSH, and I was so proud of myself. And it was awesome because it freed up all this time. And that's kind of where I first became interested in, like, I think I want to do programming. So fast forward a few years, Ruby on Rails came onto the scene, and I started digging into that and playing around with that and kind of fast forwarding some of the details. But anyway, I was looking for a job, and I live in a rural area of Colorado, which is kind of interesting because I lived in Denver for about 10 years. But once you get outside of Denver, things get a little more interesting as far as technology goes. So anyway, I got a job at a local company here where I live, but it was mainly doing PHP, specifically working with Drupal sites. And that was fun and all, but I always kind of did want to get back to the world of Rails. And so after doing that for about 5 years, while kind of keeping my interest in Rails, I finally just decided to switch. And I just sort of gave up cold turkey one day and said I was going to be a Ruby on Rails freelancer. Now, looking back, I probably would have done things a little differently because there were two things, right? One, I had, over the years, I had built up this great community of people I knew in the PHP world. And by switching to the Ruby on Rails world, I basically just kind of severed ties with all my, I mean, I'm still in touch with them, right? But it was a completely different community. So I had to kind of find new people in the Ruby on Rails community. And then secondly, you know, as far as my Java expertise and all that stuff, it was mainly in Drupal. And so I also had the second challenge of trying to find clients that I could use Ruby on Rails with. So those were the two things. And if I were to do that again, I'd probably think about that a little differently, because it did take me a while to kind of get up to speed. But after about a year, after doing a number of things, you know, Brian, you and I, we went through Block, and I also did a couple of other online courses. And
so where does Block fit in, I guess, in the timeline and that?
Yeah, sure. So so let's see. After I quit my job, what did I do? So I signed on to this other kind of Ruby on Rails class online, and it was a virtual classroom. I think there were five of us. And I was also doing a bunch of work with Agile Ventures. And let's see, how did I get to know them? I know what it was. So there was a SaaS class. I don't remember the name of the class, but it was a MOOC offered by edX. And it was...
Was it the Stanford one?
No, it was not. It was... Berkeley? No. I don't remember which one it was. I think it was Berkeley for some reason. And anyway, they had some affiliation to Agile Ventures, and so I got to really jump into this Agile Ventures group. You can still check it out today. They're doing really great work. And what it basically is people from all over the world get together and they pair program on different projects. And usually these projects come about where, you know, for all different reasons. I think a lot of them were nonprofits or something, or that were just trying to get started, and they needed some developers. And so this was a chance for you to kind of hone your skills while you're doing something good in the world. So I worked with those guys for a while. And then also the first class that I did, I did meet a number of people there. And through my contacts at that first class, it led me to taking the Block program. And so I guess the kind of take-home message from those three things was, you know, the most important thing that I did was not what I learned, but the people I met. That was incredible. That was where things really started connecting for me. Because, you know, once again, I had the challenges of living in a rural community where there's literally very little tech community here, if none. And so I had to kind of reach out to people online and to, you know, essentially build a new community in the Ruby on Rails world. And so it was through these people that really the magic started happening. And I started making connections, which, you know, eventually led to jobs and to clients. And so, you know, after about 2 years of leaving my job, you know, now I've got a pretty good steady stream of, you know, paying clients and all that kind of stuff. And really haven't done any marketing at all. It's always just been kind of through word of mouth.
Well, yeah, so you took like a different turn. I talked to you like before the podcast about this, and that like for freelancing, I actually had the opportunity to get into freelancing and start, I guess, from the bottom up, but a job opportunity came up before I was able to even do that. So I just went with the job. How did you find like your first client? I think you might have alluded it to just like probably a minute ago, but could you explain like us a little more for the listener of how you got connected to your first freelance project and how that process of starting worked out for you?
There was a woman that I met in one of my online classes, and she was working on a startup. And I had kind of, you know, kept in touch with her, you know, over the years. So we kind of pinged each other and helped each other with problems. And she came to me one day and she's like, "Hey, Jeff, what are you doing?" I was like, "Oh, you know." And she's like, "How would you like to come work for us and do some jobs? We need some help with this project that I'm working on." And so I ended up talking to her, having the conversation, and we put together kind of a plan of attack of what she was hoping to do and how I could help. And then she actually became my first paying client, which was pretty cool. And then there was another person that I met in one of my online classes too. And they also had another person reach out to them, and they were looking for a lot of Rails developers too. And she happened to pass my name on to them, and I got in touch with them, and we discussed what they needed and all that kind of stuff. And then so I started just working for them. And you know, these were all just very small project based, and that's kind of how it started in the beginning. I think we were kind of testing out the waters for each other. I had really never worked as a freelancer before. Most of my experience was just working as an employee. So this was kind of interesting, you know, as far as how you balance the scheduling and how do you get paid and all that kind of stuff. It was definitely a new world that, you know, a world that I love, but it doesn't come without its challenges for sure.
Yeah. And so as far as like compensation was, how did that work out? I mean, was it, you mentioned you lived in rural Colorado, so the cost of living is like quite different, but did you get paid comparably to what an actual developer on staff was getting paid, or do you have?
Yeah, I think so. You know, one thing when I started out, it was that question of like, okay, well, what was your rate? What is your rate? And so I had to think about that. And, you know, at the time, the way that I basically calculated it was I thought, well, what was I making at my previous job? And I kind of just took that number and I said, oh, this is my rate. Now, one thing that I was not thinking about, of course, was that there was a lot of other benefits that you get a job that aren't necessarily included in the hourly rate. And so, you know, as I went forward, I adjusted it. But I think the most important thing for me, I mean, luckily I was in a situation where I'd saved some money and I had built a cushion. So I wasn't, you know, struggling for, trying to find money to put food on the table or anything like that. I did have a little bit of a buffer to work with. So I think for me, the first thing was just trying to get that initial client, right? That initial payment flow. And even though I did start out maybe on the low side, with each contract or each new person that I found, I always just kind of upped it a little bit. And I kind of, you know, I gauged their input or their response and all that. And little by little, I just kind of ratcheted my rate up.
Yeah, it's good to note. And I know, I think a lot of people make that same mistake as far as like, especially if you're like making career changes from another career to developing, a lot of things don't get accounted for. So like myself, I was offered my first position, and I was offered actually lower than what I made in sales. So basically I just asked to get paid what I made in sales, and we just kind of agree with that. And that's what my first job was. So that was making $58,000 a year for my first dev job, mm-hmm. which was fine for me because I didn't have to worry about like a commission or anything like that. But then when I started talking to other people that like worked in the Orlando area, and they're like, "Oh, I make X, I make Y," and I was like, "Oh, well, I guess I undersold myself."
So I need to start charging more.
Yeah, luckily I got a raise in the next like 3 months after like the trial period was over. But yeah, it was just it's just interesting. Like I saw not a lot of people take an account to that, and also freelancing, like you mentioned, like benefits, like health insurance, like getting like subsidized health insurance from your employer, it makes a huge difference. And like I have a kid and I noticed like the difference. Like I work for startups, but then they'll say like, oh, we'll pay 100% of your health insurance. But it's like, oh, what about my dependents? I don't pay for them. And then it's still, it's like, I'm still like paying the same as I would have at any other company because I have to pay for two other people too. So it's just some interesting things to think about, I guess, for potential freelancers.
Yeah, absolutely. Those little hidden costs that you sometimes don't take into account. The other thing too is, you know, as an employee, it's kind of nice because you just show up, and if you're salaried, you just show up and then you leave at the end of the day and you don't really have to think about anything. But as a freelancer, it's much different, right? And if you're thinking about a regular work day where you can log 8 hours of work a day, whether you do 8 hours of work or not, you know, you're essentially logging that 8 hours a day. But as a freelancer, you know, it's impossible to log 8 hours a day as far as, you know, what you're able to bill to the client. And so one thing that I've pretty much come to is that I try to have about 4 billable hours a day. That's kind of my minimum. And if I can, you know, if I can work off that. So, you know, it all kind of starts with maybe what you want to make for the year, what you have to make for the year, and then sort of working backwards, right? But instead of saying, you know, 8 times 50 for the number of weeks in the year, assuming you're going to take a couple weeks off or whatever, it's maybe like 4 times 50, right? And then you use that in your calculations of what you're going to use to get to your hourly rate. So just one thing to kind of keep in mind is that, you know, when you think about how many hours I'm going to be able to bill a client per day, it's usually not 8 hours. It's a lot less than that because there are so many other things that you need to be doing outside of just client work.
Yeah, that's a good point too. And that's another thing that I guess not a lot you wouldn't really know, especially coming to a job where you're coding. Not 8 hours a day, like 4 hours a day, you said. But I realized pretty quickly once I started my first dev job, I was not going to be, like, even though I'm at work for 8 hours a day, I'm not going to be coding for 8 hours a day. And it's funny that you mentioned 4 hours, because 4 hours was actually my number of my goal. Actually, what I do is I time myself for every project that I work on to see how long it takes me. This is like, I've never had a job that really cared about the time that I took to do a project. Uh-huh. But for me personally, I read that the blacksmith coding guy was a blacksmith and became a coder, Joshua Kemp. And okay. He talked about tracking your hours and about the 10,000 hours to be an expert. I'm actually at almost a little over 4,000 hours now since I started programming 2.5 years ago.
Oh, and that's cool that you're keeping track of that.
Yeah, so I just keep track of all programming I do, like outside of work, inside of work. And I found that really quickly at 4 hours is like my limit. Since I moved to San Francisco, though, my hours that I work is actually 6 hours a day programming. But that's because I do quite a bit of like programming outside of work. So I have a lot of side projects that I try to keep up to date with. But yeah, that good point, like the difference between billable hours or an actual, like what you would think of as 8 hour work day is pretty good.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Is I set my minimum to 4 hours, so as long as I'm getting in 4 hours a day of billable client time, then it's good. Realistically, I usually end up doing more than that. But, you know, it's usually probably around 6 or so. But if something comes up where I need to take care of something or whatever, you know, at least I've built my kind of numbers around that 4 hour.
And you know what, you need to make up if you like spend a day at the dentist or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so explain to me like work-life balance for freelancing. I know it's different. Like I could literally show up at work and just read Reddit all day and then go home and no one would know the difference. But as a freelancer, it's probably a lot more noticeable, I'd imagine.
Yeah, absolutely, especially working out of your house. You know, there are pros and cons to that. And I think at the end of the day, I love the flexibility. I mean, it's great. I'm able to do stuff that I just wasn't able to do when I was, you know, at a regular job. And I think one of my biggest frustrations working at a job was always that, you know, I had a certain amount of things that I needed to do each day, right? I knew that I could probably get those done in 4 or 5 hours. But you had 8 hours, and you had to be there for 8 hours. And so you'd take that 4 to 5 hours worth of work, and you'd stretch it out over 8 hours. And, you know, you could fill that time in with, you know, talking to your colleagues and all that kind of stuff. But for me, it's like, I just wanted to get out. I wanted to do my work, and then I wanted to go mountain biking or something, right?
Yeah.
And so that's why the freelancing was great, because I could work when I wanted to, and there was an incentive for me to be as efficient as possible, so that when I was done, I could go do whatever I wanted to do. But now that I'm here and I'm in this boat, like I said, I wouldn't change it, but there are definitely some challenges. And, you know, one of them being I work at home, and so it's very easy for me to, let's just say I've had to really consciously define these boundaries between work and being at home, you know, and it all starts with kind of having a designated office space of where I go. And when I go into this space, I can mentally say, okay, you know, I'm here to work. And then when I leave that space, I try to leave it behind. You know, it doesn't always work that well or that way, but that's definitely my intention. And so the other thing is, you know, my wife works a regular job too. And so what I found is that, you know, if I kind of set my schedule according to hers, that seems to work out pretty well. So while she's gone during the day, that's kind of when I have scheduled my day to work. And then when she gets home, that's kind of when my end of the workday starts. And, you know, as far as other balancing points too, I'm really careful about my time and, you know, what I do with it when I am working. And it's so easy to get distracted, especially in the world of technology, because there are all these new ideas and these new technologies that are coming out that you want to dig into and chase and learn. And, you know, you just can't learn everything, right? And so talking to people, my client interactions, email and all that kind of stuff, I usually, you know, I check email about twice a day. And I just, you know, over time, that expectation is set on my clients that, listen, I will respond to you, but I'm not going to respond to you within 15 minutes of you emailing me, right? And so usually I have, you know, different times. I mean, I'll check email twice a day or sometimes more, but I usually try to stick to that. Usually, you know, in the later morning and in the afternoon as I'm wrapping up with stuff. And then throughout the day, I've tried different things like Pomodoros and all that. And then maybe between the, like on a Pomodoro break or whatever, I'll jump into Slack or, you know, sometimes jump on Skype if that's how I'm communicating with a client or whatever, and just kind of look at those messages. But then when I'm ready to go back to work, I turn all that stuff off, and I just focus on what I'm trying to do at the moment. And that's been very good for me to just kind of, you know, close all the windows that I don't need and just focus on what I'm doing at the time.
That's good. I definitely, so I'm working from home today. Actually, I work from home pretty much every Tuesday, at this point. Uh-huh. But my wife also stays at home too. So we have like kind of like an unspoken agreement of like my work time and like when they go to the park and then like nap time. So basically from like 10 to 2 is like when I get most of my work done. Cause I can work through lunch and then through nap time for my son. And then usually around 4 or 5, I start winding down. And if something needs to really get done, I might pick it up again later in the evening, but not, not for too long. But yeah, it's definitely super challenging. That's why I only do it once a week. But it's good practice too for like focusing and also cutting out the commute. I'm envious because my commute's like about 45 minutes.
Oh, yeah.
Because I have to, it used to be 25 minutes, but I have to take 2 trains because my new job is on the other side of San Francisco.
Okay.
So I have to like go through San Francisco once I get there. And then, so yeah, it's interesting. So Hopefully that was fine.
Well, I remember the old commuting days. And you know what's funny about that, Brian, is that I sometimes miss that commute, as weird as that sounds, because I found that time commuting to your job and coming back home after your job was sort of that buffer time that allowed you to sort of relax or prepare for your day, whichever way you were coming.
Yeah, it's definitely my podcast time. So like,
another thing is I started falling behind in all my podcasts. You know, I wasn't able to have that opportunity to listen to podcasts. But anyway, minor detail. But you know, it's one of those things where the grass is always greener on the other side. It's easy to get trapped in that.
Yeah, and so you mentioned you do Ruby on Rails primarily, I guess. Mm-hmm. And since you kind of like, you make sure you separate work and stuff like that, do you find time to dabble in all these new fangled like JavaScript frameworks and new languages that are popping up like every weekend?
Yeah, it's pretty overwhelming, especially in the JavaScript world where it seems like there's a new framework coming out every week, right?
Yeah.
And if you're trying to follow what all the cool kids are doing, it can be very tiring. But yeah, I do. You know, one thing that you mentioned you have a child. I have two kids myself, and so you know, once you have kids, your time, if you're a parent, you know what I'm talking about. Yeah. And so I've really come to, you know, value my time in a much different way than when I had like loads of time. And so nowadays, yes, I love technology, and I do set aside time to learn new technologies and to dig into it and stuff like that. But yeah, as far as the JavaScript stuff, I mean, in general, let's just say, you know, I think I enjoy working more on the back end. But you know, especially being a freelancer, having kind of full stack skills is pretty important because, you know, you wear many hats. I would say, you know, primarily most of the stuff that I do on the front end with JavaScript is using jQuery nowadays. However, I have started looking into, I've played around with Ember a little bit, and I dabbled with Angular. I thought those things were interesting, but never really took them very far. And I haven't done any client projects with those. But the one thing I have been looking at lately is React, which is pretty cool. Just building some, just kind of some little apps in there, playing around with it, trying to get my head wrapped around React's way of approaching things as far as the component goes and all that. But yeah, you know, there are all these technologies that come and go, and it's easy to kind of feel overwhelmed because you just never really get on top of any of them if you're always chasing the latest and greatest. But especially with Ruby on Rails right now, you know, I've spent a lot of time in the Ruby on Rails world, and I still feel like there's so much I don't know, but yet I feel like I'm also to the point where I can pretty much do anything I want with Ruby on Rails now. And so there is that level of comfort of knowing, I wouldn't say master the framework, but at least I'm comfortable with the framework. But you know, it's interesting now because now you're already starting to see a lot of people leave the Ruby on Rails world because it's no longer the cool thing to do, right? I mean,
well, I think this is more mature rather than cool. It's less exciting for sure. And I think I know you haven't kept your behind on podcasts, but the Code Newbies podcast just had Yehuda Katz on it.
And I did listen to that one, actually.
So he made a really good remark about, like, how do you keep up with all the learning? Because he was asked the same question. And he's like, basically, anything that's less than a year old, I discount. Like, it's non-existent to me. So if it hasn't been around for a year, or it's like a library that hasn't been around for a while, I don't even look into it. I just wait until the cruft falls away and it becomes a little bit more mature, and then I start looking into it. And that's a good rule to live by, especially with React, like you mentioned.
Yeah.
So like just 6 months ago, there were like about 100 different ways to implement Flux, which is their data stores. Uh-huh. And since then, now basically there's about two of them that are even like considerable to use at this moment, because most of them, everybody else has kind of like stopped maintaining them because Redux is kind of reigned supreme thus far. So It's
yeah.
Yeah. So if you waited 6 months, you'd like, which was what I did basically. If you waited 6 months, then you basically would have figured it out easier.
Yeah. Well, you know, Yehuda's pretty amazing guy. And I think that that's definitely great advice. And, you know, that's kind of where I was with the JavaScript frameworks too, about a year or so ago. They were just coming out left and right. And I'm like, what is going on? And so I just kind of took a back seat and was hoping that they'd start to settle down. And who knows? I mean, this technology is never going to completely stop. And that's the great thing about it. But I think there is something to be said about that, about, you know, using mature technologies. And I, you know, going back to our Rails talk, or, you know, talking about Rails, you know, as we mentioned, or as I was mentioning, a lot of the, you know, the cool kids are switching to something else, you know, something more functional or whatever. Elixir gets mentioned a lot nowadays, along with the Phoenix framework, which is essentially like Rails, but using Elixir instead of Ruby. And I think all that stuff's fascinating. I think it's really cool. And, you know, as far as if you're going to run into concurrency issues, that sounds like the framework to use. But I think in all honesty, like, if you just want to build something, I mean, Rails is going to work for, you know, 98% of the people. And, you know, even to just get an idea out the door, Rails is just a great way to kind of quickly prototype something, get it up and working, and have people playing around with it, you know. And once you start to get that input from people, then I think it'll give you much better direction on where you want to go with your project. So, yeah, I mean, I think there's a fine balance there, right? About, you know, keeping the true and tested technologies close to you, you know, so that at any one time you're able to build something, right? But then as time goes on, there are going to be all these new things introduced. And as long as you can kind of maintain that core set of, you know, abilities to be able to do things, to build stuff, then I think you can kind of maybe slowly evaluate what's out there and sort of introduce those into your tool chain. And then who knows, maybe even replace one of those new toys with something you've been using for years.
Yeah, very true. Well, Jeff, basically going to wrap it up there. But yeah. I just want to thank you very much for coming on and sharing your experiences as a freelancer, and kind of how you got into that position that you basically put yourself in. And that sounds bad, but I guess it's a good thing. Anyway, yeah. Thanks again for coming on. And yeah, best of luck to your further career as a freelancer.
Yeah, thanks, Brian. This was fun. Awesome. Take care, and we'll talk to you soon.
Yep. So, guys, that was Jeff Thomas. Not as much known, but hopefully you guys know him now. Follow him on Twitter if you can. If you're on Twitter, hopefully you are, because that's pretty much how I share this podcast. But if you want to help share this podcast, leave a review on iTunes. I basically have given up on Stitcher. Stitcher is dead to me. So don't review on Stitcher. Don't listen on Stitcher. Anyway, review on iTunes. Also, coming up in the next few weeks, I am going to be chatting with some other people. I've got actually quite a few other interviews I'm doing this month. Next podcast out next week. I'm looking forward to talking to you guys. If you are in the SF area, please hit me up. I'm a BWO on Twitter. I am pretty available. I go to a lot of meetups. If you come by, I know a lot of people came in for WWDC. Actually connected with somebody. Actually connected with Rob DeLuca. He was episode 41-ish. Yeah, he came and we hung out. We had lunch. So definitely hit me up and let's do lunch. Let's do coffee. With that being said, I will see you next week.